Hello and welcome to the Gut Feeling Podcast, speaking with musicians on how they found their sound. I'm your host, Gregory Adams. Gut Feeling is both a podcast and a bi-weekly newsletter showcasing interviews, gear talks, label guides, and more, all of which is archived at buttondown.email/gutfeeling, where you can likewise subscribe to have posts and podcasts hit your inbox directly. This latest podcast is a talk with Murray Lightburn, the longtime member of orchestral pop group The Deers, who is likewise releasing his third solo album, Once Upon a Time in Montreal, March 31st through Dangerbird Records. Murray has described the album as an audio version of a biopic inspired by the life of his father, William, a jazz saxophonist, and it's somewhat based on stories his mother told him following his father's passing in 2020. It's a contemplative but massively moving collection of jazz, folk, and vintage R&B sounds, all of which anchored by the golden tone of Murray's voice. I'll be honest, Murray's on my shortlist. He has been for decades, with an oaken vibrato that's floored me from the earliest Deer songs through to now. So we get into the album. We get into how Murray came up singing in the church, also went through a gothier phase, and how he's gone about refining his voice over the years. There's some technical talk. We also touch on his recent score for Canadian filmmaker Chandler Levesque's feature debut, I Like Movies. But before all that, Murray and I break bread, if you will, over his series of Instagram posts about baking bread. Tell me about your loaves of bread. You didn't give a full update, you know.
I got sidetracked by work, but I did bake. But I got sidetracked by work. I, you know, just kind of putting out fires and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah. How often do you bake bread?
Like maybe once a week, because, you know, there's a few people who like fresh bread, so I'll offer some to friends and stuff.
Yeah. What got you into that?
Actually, my friend Sebastian Granger, from a band called Death From Above. Mm-hmm. We've been friends for I don't know, going on 20 years, I'd say. And he sent me a book from the Tartine Bakers. It's a place in, I think, in California. And he sent me that book, and I didn't open it for probably an entire year. And then I was like, oh, you know what, I'm gonna try it finally. And then a bunch of fails happened, and then I got discouraged, and then I picked it up again, only just because I just wanted to. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I have always liked to know how things work. I always, you know, I really get into troubleshooting and problem solving, and very into that ever since I was a kid. And so yeah, I just kind of like, I troubleshot every step of the way until I had my first real successful bake, and I haven't looked back since.
Yeah. How simple was that? You know, after the troubleshooting with the first perfect, I'll say, like the first perfect, yeah, loaf, like what kind of a bread was that?
What do you mean, the first one that was a fail, or the first one that was a success?
Well, you know what? Let's go with both.
Well, I mean, you know, the first bake, you know, you have this a weird sense of accomplishment, but you know that it's failed. But it's like, I guess you try to, like, you know, salvage it by saying, oh, it tastes pretty good and whatever. It's just like, but you know, it's a fail. Deep down, you know, you failed. You did not execute all of the steps. And the hardest thing actually was the shaping, which is the very last phase before you do your final proof. And once I got a hang of the shaping, it made everything, you know, different. Mm-hmm. And so I got a hang of the shaping, and also patience, man. Patience, patience, patience. It really requires a great deal of patience to get to that. And even still now, you know, you have to have a lot of patience and perseverance, like life.
Yeah.
So I kind of started to see it as this metaphor, and really wanted to see it through. And so when I got my first real successful bake with a nice ear and the whole crust and just like, you know, nailed it right down the middle. Yeah. And once I got to that point, it was like really like I never had a fail after yeah. that. It's like, okay, I know exactly where I went wrong previously, what I have to do going forward to have a perfect loaf every time.
What are some of the more ambitious flavors? Like, I guess this is presupposing that there are some out there kind of flavors, but like, is this like
I don't really mess with that. I think like there's something about a simple loaf that is almost poetic, just doing that one thing. I did one time like a confit garlic loaf, which was not bad. And another time I think I did something with pumpkin seeds. It comes down a bit more to the flour too, you know. Like I picked up some flour in Toronto at this place called Broad Flour, and mm-hmm. it was a really, really, really nice and tasty flour that I would totally bake with again. And I think that's something I'd fuck with more something I'd mess with more than like, you know, raisins or nuts or, you know, strawberries or I don't know, chocolate chips, you know, all that kind of gross stuff. I just like a nice basic loaf. I mean, it's weird because I live in Montreal. Like we don't, you know, Montreal has good bread. You can get good bread in Montreal. Not all cities are like that, but I guess it's becoming more prevalent now. I mean, maybe it's past being a fad now, but like definitely people were getting into baking. But I've always been, I do all the cooking in the house, all of it. It's almost never, only when I'm on tour does someone else cook, but I do all the cooking and I take it pretty seriously. I meal plan, I think ahead, I go and I get all the things I need. I make fresh pasta, I do all kinds of stuff. I make all kinds of stuff from scratch. I don't use any packaged anything. All my sauces are made from scratch. You know, I research them. You know, I like to know that kind of stuff. But I mean, I grew up cooking, like, you know, from when mm-hmm. I was a kid.
Now, this is not a clever segue, but thinking about just building things up from scratch, like I wanted to bring you on here to get into your voice in particular, or you know, perhaps the multiple voices that you bring to this new solo album. But, you know, without sidetracking too much, I also want to get into the other big release of yours this month, being the instrumental soundtrack work for Chandler Levesque's I Love Movies. Like, how did you get involved in that project?
Well, Chandler and I have worked together before, so we kind of developed a relationship, friendship, a kinship. You know, we have a similar kind of dorky sense of humor, I think, and we both love The Simpsons and Simpsons references. So, you know, it just it's very natural to work together, I think. At least it felt that way for me, you know, felt pretty natural. And you know, I'm quite a bit older, but for, you know, and I have trouble relating sometimes to people around, you know, her age, but for some reason I don't have trouble relating to her, you know, so mm-hmm. that's kind of cool. And so she, you know, got in touch and she told me about this movie she was making. I mean, I knew she was making a movie and I just kind of assumed that she had a composer already. I didn't even bark up that tree. I didn't even offer to do the music for it. I just kind of assumed that, you know, she was seeing what else was out there. But in the end, she did call me up to work on it. It surprised me because they were so far into production at that point. Like, I didn't know anything. I was like bottom of the ninth, two outs and the bases loaded kind of pitcher for this project. So I was really, I had to spend a lot of time just catching up to the world that they had built. So that was the challenge. But once I felt kind of caught up and I really immersed myself in the project, I kind of felt like, okay, I get it now. And it made, working on it easier, you know.
Tell me about like the experience of like writing cues, you know, like working with the movie. Like, were you constantly watching the movie to get inspired by it, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that I always say to people that it's kind of like, you know, you're a dressmaker, you know, like the Phantom Thread guy, you know. But you're kind of like a dressmaker, and you go in and you take your measurements, and then you talk to the person about, you know, what they want to wear, like what, you know, what kind of material do they want? What kind of, look do they want? You know, do they want like something sleek, or do they want something frilly, or do they want, you know what I mean? And you have those conversations, and then I go about banging up some designs, and then I don't go dumpster diving on any project of like, oh, what didn't I use for such and such? I'll grab that, you know, and this and that. Everything is always inspired by the work before me, always. Whatever doesn't make it just winds up in the dumpster, you know, in my hard drive dumpster that one day I'll just put together and use for something, but not for anybody's project. I prefer to really just kind of get inspired by what inspired them, you know, because that's the real nature of collaboration. You know, you feed off of each other. It's for me to come in and be like, oh, I've got a bunch of junk I'm not using, let's use that, you know. Even if it, whether, and I've experienced that before, specifically when, you know, when we were taking submissions for music videos in the past with the Deers, you'd have these directors come in, and you can always tell, oh, that's a rejected idea from another band. You know, they're just trying to, you know, slap it on this band. You know, they weren't inspired by the music. They just had an idea, and they just want to use whatever to get their idea out. And that's not something I ever appreciated. And so I think it's only right for me to, not employ that, just be like, oh, well, this failed over here, I'll just try it over here, you know. And and there was a couple of moments in Chandler's movie where I woke up one morning, and from watching the film like probably a dozen times, and one morning I woke up and I heard this piece of music in my head, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it. And the only thing, and it was I knew exactly where I wanted to put it. And so I went about, you know, at my sewing machine, you know, and started putting together this dress for that scene in the movie. And then I was able to see this sort of through line, you know, for the cues and how the cue would evolve for another section of the movie, and how it became the theme of, you know, two of the main characters, just kind of this relationship that they had. And I wanted to do like a sort of parallel storytelling with this piece of music. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple pieces of music like that. So there was like about three or four different themes that you hear recurring, but played out differently, not being used always exactly the same. It's more just like, the evolution of this relationship is as such, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of what I wanted to do with it. This was like the first kind of breakthrough I had with the film, because I had been beating my head against the wall with a few things. But I found that the key to breaking through was the getting like a real bolt of lightning inspiration. It was crucial. And that was the first time I actually kind of, it really opened up a lot of doors in the film for me. And so I you know, I texted Chandler as I was like, and crossing my fingers that she was going to get it, you know. I said, I got something. It's pretty big because it spans over four scenes and I want to show you something. And so I queued up the four scenes. I had all the music for those scenes and I wanted to show her this through line through those scenes. They happen in separate parts of the movie, but they're tied together. It's like part of the same thread. And so I wanted to show her, and it's just like, so it goes like this here, it goes like this here. And then at the end we get, you know, the sort of climax, let's say, you know, and it's the same theme, but, you know, you hear different components of it. And so it's very complex. And then seeing it in the theater for the first time when I was at TIFF, I was just like, I got a little bit misty because it worked so well. And there was one moment in the film where I could hear the audience react. And, you know, I am not taking credit for the film at all, but I just know that it's my job to help guide the audience to those moments. And when I heard them react to this one scene, I felt like what I intended to do with the piece was happening. It's like my own little like accomplishment to myself. I'll never get an award for it. No one will ever acknowledge it. But for me, I felt like my instincts were right. I did right by the film. And I was sitting in a theater, a full theater, and heard the entire audience gasp in that moment. And it's like the music that was the theme that was playing underneath was the theme that I wanted to lead them to that. Because when I was explaining it to Chandler, it's just like, you know, when we get here, you know, this whole thing has been told, you know, it's tied up in a nice little bow, you know? And so that was like that was something that I had never experienced before in my entire career as a musician. I played lots of shows. I played Glastonbury. We've been on Letterman a couple times. Like lots of really cool little things have happened in my career. You know, nothing like that. Like that particular experience was new and I am not young. So it was just kind of nice to have that experience and know that I can still have experiences like that, you know, at my age and this deep into my career, that there's another frontier, you know. Every day is a tribute to all the things I imagined of you.
Maybe this is a good time to transition into talking about Once Upon a Time in Montreal. I was interested in something that you told Range, that you said the voice on this record is mostly my father's voice, but it could be me or my father singing in the first person. Maybe a different kind of relationship there than we were speaking on earlier. Like, what can you tell me about just the process of writing through various voices of the Lightburns?
Well, I've kind of refined that since I spoke to Range a little bit, but the narrative voice on this record is a bit of a conversation that I kind of wish happened. It's a bit imaginary, you know, in that there's a couple songs where I'm wishing I could have said certain things when I had the chance. But even though I knew that none of these conversations were ever going to happen, it's just not the Lightburn way. But I could pretend and therefore, you know, kind of wrestle a couple things to the ground and move on with my life, you know, because it's a pretty big thing when you lose a parent. I don't know if you still have your folks with you, but, you know, that you'll that only happens twice, it seems. And for me, this was my first experience with that. It was I was, as much as you think you're prepared for that, you're not. You never will be prepared for when it's done and it's final and they're gone. And, you know, there was just a lot of blank space between my father and I, let's just say. And so this is the only way I could fill it, you know. And I think in the wake, just like in the, because you know, when at, right after he went, I had to, you know, my mom kind of dumped a bunch of stuff on me to deal with, you know, dealing with the government and dealing with the funeral home and, you know, the bank and this, that, and the other. And so I was pretty preoccupied with a lot of that. And so when that all was settled and, you know, it was starting to be in the rearview mirror, yeah, I sat down to write, you know, because then I was alone with my thoughts. Yeah. And so I sat down to write, and the first couple songs I wrote was just like things that I wanted to say and wanted to talk about. And then, but then I was just like, what's his side of the story going to be? And so that's when I really kind of put things into focus, was just like imagining that. And so I started to, when I say sing in his voice, I'm not affecting how he spoke, not even how I think he would express things. I just sort of gathered information from my mother about him, that things I never knew about. And so I started to put them to paper and draw from that, you know, this happened and that happened and this happened and that happened. This is why I did that. This is why I did that. And this is, and it really kind of helped me to understand where he was coming from more. And I was able, you know, even though like my relationship with him really kind of didn't really go very far. I mean, he did give me everything. He gave me everything about me. He gave me music. He gave me this life, you know, everything around me. Yeah, he gave that to me. I would not have pursued, you know, what I have without that kind of influence, you know. Not that, yeah. And he didn't even want me to be a musician. That's the thing that's so funny. Yeah. He thought I should do something else.
You started young, no education, only books from Genesis to Revelation.
This is kind of a broad question, but like, what are some of your earliest memories of music and you know, those being attached to him? Because he was a saxophonist. Was he a full-time saxophonist around Montreal?
When I was born, he was a full-time musician. He was on the road a lot. And after I was born, he kind of hung up his skates, as they say, because now my parents were three kids in and my dad being on the road wasn't going to work. You know, and my mom, you know, this is like the 70s. She, you know, was a nurse. And back then they didn't have maternity leave. You know, they like she had like, I think like 2 weeks off or something crazy like that, and then had to go to work. And it was very, very difficult, you know. But to answer your question, my experiences were mostly after my parents became born again Christians and we started going to church. That's when, you know, music became more dominant in our lives. My father started to get involved musically at church. My mother played piano in the church. And then I sang in the church when I was like 5 or 6 years old. That was my first public performance, singing solo. It was terrifying and traumatizing for me. And, but that's what I became known for from that age, you know, to sing.
What kind of songs were you singing at the church?
Like church songs, you know, everything from like Blessed Assurance to more contemporary of the time songs. I think there was a song written by, I think, what's his name? Jimmy Swaggart. Jesus Got a Hold of My Life was a song I sang.
Yeah.
I sang, you know, Christmas songs like Silent Night and O Little Town of Bethlehem was a big one for me. And, you know, just a lot of that, you know, a lot of traditional hymns and stuff like that.
Do you have recordings or anything? This is part oh, maybe God, where I'm no. going with this. Because like the idea of you having a child's voice, it doesn't quite add up in my mind. Like even early on in the Deers, you just had this rich, robust, kind of mature voice. So I'm curious to hear what that could have sounded like.
I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, I've been singing my whole life and I've just But at some point, I guess through like the sort of puberty years, you know, I started playing drums when I was like 12 or 13. And so I was singing less and I was, you know, playing drums in the church at the time. And then when I was 15, I picked up the guitar, and that's when I really kind of got into a lot of stuff. I started getting to rock music and learning, you know, music of the time, you know, REM riffs and U2 riffs and Smith's riffs and The Cult and The Cure and anything that was coming out in the 80s that had guitar on it, you know, mm-hmm. I was learning it. And so I spent a lot of time doing that. And then towards the end of high school, I started singing in bands for the talent show. So at that point, my child's voice was gone. It was, you know, it was like closer to the voice. I mean, I had way more range back then, but closer to what it is now, tenor, baritone type of thing. But I remember even back then, there was certain songs in certain keys I always had trouble with, like anything written in D was just going to be a tough one for me, and still is. And for some reason, I still write songs in D for the Deers and I struggle with those songs every time.
So, sometimes, you know, struggling for those notes that makes the piece. I think of something like, you know, like the Four Tops, oh gosh, why is his name escaping me?
The guy who sang falsetto, you mean?
The lead in the Four Tops.
Yeah.
Oh, the name is escaping me, but that's the whole thing of his voice. Like all of those performances are that he's reaching past like his threshold. And that's what makes those songs.
Yeah. I mean, I reckon there's something to it, but the other thing about it is that it's kind of like flying too close to the sun. You know, I'm finding out as I get older, you know, that my voice doesn't quite have, there's certain songs in the Deers catalog that I would struggle to sing now, like that my voice just won't go up that high. There's one song in particular on the first album called There's No Such Thing as Love. And it's like this weird modulation that happens throughout that song. It just seems to go on forever. It's just so stupid. I don't know what I was thinking, but it gets to one point where it's just right at the, even back then, and I was in my 20s, you know, it just gets to the very, 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 very top of the mountaintop. Like I don't think my voice could go any higher. And I'm there and I'm singing it so high in falsetto, so ridiculously high. And now I've tried many times, can't sing that note. And I remember seeing you know, David Bowie talk about certain songs that he couldn't sing anymore. His, you know, of years of, you know, as he was getting older, like he just couldn't sing them anymore. And there's lots of singers who go through that as they age, songs that they sung in the earlier days when they were more carefree and felt they could do anything. I think that's, you know, that's what I mean by flying too close to the sun. You know, it's just like you kind of sing without, You there's no way for you to know what your range is going to be in like 50 years, you know?
So what kind of things early on were you working on? Like, I think about your vibrato in particular, but like what were some of the elements of your voice that you were working on as you were, you know, in a teenager, like sorting things out?
I mean, we played lots of covers, you know, in our teenage years, like, you know, me and my friends, we played a lot of talent shows and parties and stuff like that. And we just played stuff that people knew, you know. I mean, at the same time, like, did they really know that music? I don't know. I mean, it was getting popular. I mean, we played a lot of like I was saying before, we played a lot of like U2 songs from like anything from War and to the, I guess, the Joshua Tree at the time. And, you know, we played The Cure and And that was weird because it, you know, you would affect a little bit those singers, you know, like when you're singing those songs. And it's funny because a lot of people say, oh, you sound like Morrissey, you know, and it's like, and the story of that is really funny to me because when I was in high school, I'd never heard of the Smiths at all. And this kid at school, he'd heard me sing and he said, you sound a lot like this guy. You should check this band out. I think you'd like them. He gives me a cassette of Hatful of Hollow, a Smiths album. And I take it home. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy, you know? And it was, the thing is, I was less interested in the singing and way more interested in the guitar playing. So I really, like, I just tried to learn all the guitar on those records and was became a really Smiths fan, mostly because I loved the music and the arrangements of the music a lot. And the singing was funny sometimes and cool and interesting. But it wasn't the thing. It wasn't the thing that drew me in. The thing that drew me in was Johnny Marr's guitar playing and his arrangements, and just like, just being completely like what is he doing? And then finding out years and years later, oh, he's capoing on this fret, and he's got a weird tuning on this guitar, and blah blah blah. Just fun. That did not dawn on me when you're just a novice guitar player that there was a capo. I didn't have a capo. Weird tunings. What are you talking about, weird tunings? How do you play a weird tuning, you know? I was just in standard tuning, open string, you know, and trying to learn some of these really complicated guitar parts, not realizing that half the time he had capos or whatever, you know, sometimes not. But so I digress. I'm just saying, like, I was really always less interested in singing. It was just like, you know, in the absence of having a singer, I sung. That's always been my job. It wasn't until the last 10 years that I have worked more, like, well, not work, but embraced being a singer. You know what I mean? All the time that, you know, that I've been a singer in a band, both professionally and as a younger person in just crappy bands, whatever. It was always just like, in the absence of anybody getting behind the microphone in this outfit that I'm in, well, I guess I'll do it because I can, you know? Yeah. It comes easy to me.
My head is full of melody. I can't seem to shake the tragedy of unreconciled relationships.
There is a line on this record, on Reaching Out for Love, of My Mind is Full of Melody. You mentioned, you know, working on cover songs. At what point do you start making original music?
I think it was, I was in my, I was about my last year of high school, started like dabbling in writing our own songs, and we did like a recording, you know, on an 8-track reel to reel of 3 songs. And, my brother used to call it, my big brother used to call it dead people music because it was kind of gothy. And so, yeah, so we kind of dabbled in our own music back then. And, you know, it's funny, we were talking about the whole baking thing, you know, before, but it's like, you know, those first few songs, it's like yeah, this is pretty good, you know, it tastes not bad. It's like, no, it's not good, you know? And so that was the beginning of my journey of being a composer, you know, and just really finding my way, finding my voice. You know, you do a lot of imitating at first until you really find your own voice. You know, I'm going to bring this up again. It's inspiration. You know, you don't just sit down to write for the sake of writing. You know, I used to practice guitar all the time. Now I'm a terrible guitar player, terrible piano player, terrible musician across the board, because at some point it was like I was singing, and then I wanted to be, then I was like, I really embraced being a musician. So I was like learning instruments, like really trying to get an understanding of a variety of instruments. You know, I even was dabbling in the cello at one time. My dad desperately tried to teach me how to play horn, you know, but I have working knowledge of a lot of instruments, how they work, the sounds they can make, the range that they have. You know, I've spent a lot of time understanding the mechanics of playing music. And then at some point, I started to go down the rabbit hole of being a writer. And like I was always into poetry all through high school. I was a big poetry guy, obviously secretly. And I always wrote poetry. I still write poetry. But then I really started to read a lot and, you know, maybe wanted to be a writer, you know, for a time, like a lot of people, you know, thought maybe I could be a writer, you know. And so I really got into writing and reading more than anything. I really read a lot of books through my, you know, late teens through all my 20s, you know. Just like I literally be that fucking, I remember seeing like this kid walking down the street reading a book, and I laughed at with Natalia. It's like, that was me, like in my 20s, just walking down the street reading a book. You know, like you just never put down a book. You're just constantly reading all the time. And I would rip through books in like a day or two, you know, like just the way, especially something that I was really interested in. I just like ripped through them. And so that really gave me a sense of putting words together. I always talk about, you know, when you write words, like you can write words, but when you're a songwriter, you have to write words that are singable. You know, like you can write something brilliant, but can you write something brilliant and fucking falls off the, you know, just everything falls out and drops nicely? That's not drivel. That's something that now into my career as a writer is that I'm really zeroing in on, is being able to write something that is compelling, but also just, you know, just really falls off the tongue and sounds very pleasing to the ear to hear, you know?
Yeah. Now, I want to tie that to something you mentioned a little earlier about just, you know, the mechanics of learning instruments, you know, your father teaching you, you know, desperately trying to teach you how to play the trumpet. Like, did you ever have like deep musical conversations?
Saxophone, actually. Saxophone. Terrible, terrible, terrible experience. I actually have his horn right over here. His old horn is a, show it to you. It's in his old Selmer. I don't know if you can see that over there.
Oh yeah, I could see that in the corner.
Yeah, the Selmer Mark. Sorry, I'll give you get you a better view. The Selmer Mark 7. Yeah. So after he died, I got all his horns. So
yeah. Did my question on that though is like, did you know, while he was trying to get you to learn that instrument, did you ever have like deep musical conversations about the mechanics of your voice? Like, was he a singer at all?
No, he could sing, but the thing that he used to say that I still remember and I still tell other people, you know, he was a man of few words, and but when he said something, it would almost be like haiku, you know, or like something very succinct, but like really is like the absolute crux of what needs to be said. And he said to me, sing from your belly, not from your throat. That's what he said. And he's absolutely correct. Yeah. So in the mechanics of singing, you know, that's the thing. My father was very knowledgeable about how to make music. And so he would always, you know, tell me little things, you know, information that I needed, you know, to get over certain hurdles, you know, but he would always do it in this weird kind of like combination of words and, you know, sing from your belly, not from your throat. You know, okay, what the fuck does that mean? You know? Yeah. But then, you know, as I understood it and how I understand it now, it is a big, very big part of being able to get power and to like where all the power comes from. Singing, it comes from down here, not from here. And so the throat is just, it's just, you just, it's just passing through, you know?
How was his horn playing? Was it likewise, you know, economical, efficient, like, or was it, you know, did he develop?
Well, I mean,
like
you
a...
could hear for yourself. He played on the first song on the Dears Missiles album, a song called Disclaimer. He plays horn on that, and he plays horn on the third album, the very last song, Find My Way to Freedom. And you know, he did like three or four passes, and that was it. You know. Okay, you got enough? All right. Okay. That's my dad, you know. Just not a lot of words. And then when he came into play, it was just like, here's the passage. You know, I didn't give him anything to play. I just said, just blow something, you know, like what he's done his whole life. And just improv, you know? And so he would just rattle something off, and then, you know, we'd do a couple more takes, and that would be that. Three takes max, you know?
Was that a similar treatment to Once Upon a Time in Montreal, the title track, the saxophone? Like, does that sax solo, like, speak to his playing?
When we got there, yes. Like, a lot of these guys, they come in absolutely cold AF, man. They don't know a note. They haven't heard anything. And we're recording to tape. So it's not like, you know, we're just going to comp it all later. It's like, no, you got it. When you leave, that's what you heard. That's what you're going to hear on the record. So that level of commitment and getting it right is a part of the atmosphere in when you're making records with me anyway, because we normally record to tape and we commit in the moment to things, you know, because there's that studio culture of like, you know, I'll record it a million times, and then some poor bastard is sitting there, you know, getting carpal tunnel, you know, editing your performance into something completely unnatural, and then that's what everybody hears. So what we do is we just, you know, rehearse and go over it and, you know, talk about it. And then we take a stab until we're happy. And Frank, you know, he had not heard anything. You know, I just said, here are the keys. It's like, you know, this kind of vibe, that, this kind of vibe, et cetera. I only gave him his very first note. I said, I just hear it coming in with this note. Yeah. And so that was his first note every time. And that was like very similar to the way my dad communicates, because it's just like, I'm just going to give you one note and then it's all you. That one note should dictate how you're going to speak to me. And that's what we did. And once I gave him that note, because at first I didn't give him anything. And then he said, is there something you want to do? And I said, man, I'll be honest with you. I just hear this one note and it's starting with this one note. And I gave him that note. And from there, that's when we started to get the takes.
Yeah.
And then a few takes in, you know, he would come in and goes, did we get it? And I was just like, that was, you know, it was too much for me. It was like too close to home. I had to take a minute, because it was just like, that was absolutely it, you know.
Well, what can you tell me about just like the general flow of this record, the songs that you put together? Like, there's like elements of jazz. There's some kind of soulful blues on like a song like "But My Heart Has Never Been Dark." There's some like French chanson
really,
with the title
it's
track.
It's really kind of like a marriage of like a lot of things that I grew up hearing around the house. You know, I tried to imagine something that my old man would have on in his car, you know, that he would have listened to. And so I feel like I knew his tastes pretty well, because I grew up with them. And I mean, he was a massive, massive, massive Coltrane fan. Like, he just would never shut up about Coltrane. But also, he was in a band that they were kind of a rhythm and blues band, you know, but like from the 70s, man. So that meant, you know, electric piano, drums, bass, and saxophone was the configuration of this group. It wasn't like sequences and beats and whatever, like modern R&B. It's like,
yeah,
you know, it was like that kind of combo. And so, I mean, those guys were serious musicians and could play anything. They had to play a lot of covers to make a living. But, you know, I would always hear them jam when they were just playing for their own enjoyment. And it was full out jazz, you know. So, but they had to learn how to play Rock the Boat.
Yeah. Yeah. What can you tell me about just the way we've kind of hinted at this a bit, but just the way that your voice has evolved over the years? I think maybe control is one way that I'm thinking about this, just, you know, compared to the voice cracking early days. Like, tell me about singing from the belly, but in a almost a subtler way.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing about, you know, when I was talking about what I was driving at with, like, you know, started out singing and then I really got focused in instrumentation and learning about that, and then writing and composing. And then what's left to do after that is to refine all of those things, right? And they all kind of work in concert together. They all inform each other. So my deep dive into performance and instrumentation informs this, that, and the other. And the singing informs this, and the writing informs this. So it's like you're really trying to focus all that knowledge and energies into the perfect bite, you know? And so that's kind of where I am now, is like taking, you know, all the things that I know and executing things accordingly. So when I get behind the mic now, it's very automatic. You know, it's very second nature to, like, I do get very technical behind the microphone. I have to learn all my moves before a take, like where I'm going to take my breaths, how long I'm going to hold my note, when I'm going to hit the vibrato, or whether I'm going to even hit vibrato. Do I want to keep it straight, or do I want to bring in some vibrato? And all those things are very, very, very technical. And really, like, the engine room of all of those things is air. It's crazy. And how much air and the release, most importantly, the release of that air. You kind of want more air than less air, always. And then you can just kind of control how that air is used. And that's where I am now, is really in that space where when I sing, I'm in full control of the release of that air. Sometimes it's a psst, and sometimes it's a whoosh, you know?
Take my hand, I'll pull you near. In the dark before the dawn, oh, dawn.
Maybe with some of that in mind, I wonder if we can get into a particular song on the record. Girl, You've Got to Let Me Go.
That was testing me all the way.
That, you know, there's that very extended vibrato passage. It sounds like you're pulling away from the mic as your voice is rising. It's like this beautiful, heartbreaking moment on the record. Like, what can you recall about tracking that take?
It was really hard because, again, it's one of these songs that was getting to the edge of my range. And, you know, it's also... there's a weird spot with my voice now that I'm learning, is where it's breaking falsetto, and I have to make a decision where I'm going to sing in my natural voice or falsetto. And that was one of those things where it's just like, I could easily hit it in falsetto because it's at the lower part of my falsetto, but it doesn't have the open-throated power that the part needs. So it's a big decision to make. It informs how it's going to be received. It informs everything about the track, because I could sing it in falsetto and it becomes something else meaningfully, you know, like becomes something else, another sort of character and approach. Or I can just go for it, see what happens, and it's like driving off a fucking cliff, you know?
And how much of that could be dictated by just the actual line that that's happening on of no more bullshit, only joy, just, you know, like opening up that throat, letting that joy out. That's very navel gazing.
Well, I think that's interesting. That's an interesting question, because that really does, you know, you can't sing that line in falsetto and a little more demure, you know, you have to put it all on the table for a line like that. So it was an easy decision to make. But if it was a different line and a different word, maybe I could get away with the falsetto. You dig what I'm saying?
I dig it.
Right tool for the right job.
Yeah.
And your voice has a couple of tools in it. And so for me, I'm still learning what those tools are. And that was one of those moments where I was overloading the microphone, and you can even hear it, you know, like I'm overloading the channel. I'm like Scotty giving it all she's got, Captain, you know, like all the way, all the dilithium crystals are all in there, man.
Yeah.
Girl, it's time to let me go.
So this is a record that, you know, contends with legacy, with family, like having created a dialogue of sorts. Like, where are you on the other end of this album with, you know, thinking about your father, thinking about those conversations that you wanted to have?
You know, it's funny, the album's coming out soon and, you know, people bring it up, you know, oh, your album's coming out soon. And it's like, you know, some of my friends or whatever. I'm just like, yeah. It's already pretty far in the rear view mirror for me. Like, you know, like my father died, you know, like 3 years ago this year. And sure, when I was making the record, you know, 2 years later, you know, I definitely had some emotional bumps on the road. But before that, you know, once I had finished writing it, which was like, I finished writing it almost a year before we went into the studio, or like 6 months before we went to the studio, actually. Once I finished writing it and I knew what we were making and what I was going to do and all the things I wanted to do, I became very busy with preparing for the session. So I had a bit of a detachment from the content, you know, because I was really focused on the production. And then, you know, we went and we made it, and I had a few emotional moments in the studio. One of them was right towards the end when we were mixing, and, you know, it was just me, Howard, and Luch in the studio. Luch is Jeff Luciani, played drums. Just me, Howard, who produced it, co-produced it or recorded it, and Luch and I. And, you know, I was starting to tell them some stories about my old man, and I got very emotional, you know. And that was like the last sort of time where the waterworks really started to happen, you know, for me. And I felt like that was like the last of it coming out, you know, in that moment in the studio, because we were basically just finished the record. We had just finished mixing that song that you just mentioned. From when I left the studio that day and the album had been mixed, that's the moment I closed the door and started to drive away. And
yeah.
Now that's been, you know, over a year And so I'm pretty far removed from it. But the thing is like, here's the thing. Like, as much as it's like a personal deal, there's a lot about it that I hope other people are able to relate to in their journey. Like, I don't make these records for myself. I have an opportunity to do something. And as I learned this when I was touring solo, you know, I was out on the road and I met a lot of people who otherwise I would have never met, you know, like, because I'm by myself. I guess a bit more approachable when I'm not surrounded by the deers and don't have to really engage as much, let's just say, you know, because I have that buffer of being in the band and following where the band has to be. And but when you're touring by yourself, just you and a guitar, and you're sitting at the bar having your dinner, you know, you become more approachable to people who have been following the band. And so I met a lot of people like that, you know, like they would just come and they would sit and tell me how song X helped them through their divorce and song Y helped them through, you know, the loss of their mother and et cetera, et cetera. And it's just like, and I really started to open my eyes about my role, you know. Now, every time I go into the studio now, I think of those people and I think of the music that I write, like the stories that I tell. I try to write them in such a personal way that people can wear them. They can adopt them for their own way because they're not able to write songs. You know, they haven't spent their life writing songs. They haven't spent their life learning instruments. They spent their lives doing something else, but they really want to participate in something that makes them feel human, makes them feel in touch with what's going on with them. And I think that's the power of music, you know, and film and books and art in general, you know, that's a very powerful thing. And unfortunately, you know, creators are getting, you know, are in a chokehold, you know, because we do this thing and everything gets squeezed out of us. And then we're left with not much, you know, to continue to do what we do. it gets really, really hard. But like what our role and what we do is very important to the fabric and the soul of humankind. Like, imagine a world without films, without books, without movies, without music. Like, imagine that world if we had none of it, if we never had the Beatles, if we never had Graham Greene, if we never had, you know, Scorsese. Imagine that world. Imagine that fucking world. That's a seriously dark world. That's a lot of darkness. And so I take that gig pretty seriously, you know. I'm not saying I'm Scorsese or the Beatles or that. I'm just saying, so it's like my small job is, you know, serving. I'm like a boutique, you know. I'm the guy who's making his own sourdough bread and a couple people line up to get that sourdough loaf from me. You know, those are my songs.
Yeah. Maybe thinking about legacy in a different way. This is a bit of a side journey, but you have one of your children plays music as well, right?
My oldest is interested in music. Yes.
Yeah. Do they sing?
Yeah.
I guess
I think so. I mean, I know Neptune can sing, and play bass and play drums and play guitar. I mean, the kid is a dynamo.
This is a bit of an abstract question or thought perhaps, but like, can you hear your child's voice through Neptune?
I don't know. I don't know what I sounded like as a child. There might be tapes. I doubt it. I don't think if they're anywhere, they're in a garbage dump or, you know, like, I don't know what I sounded like. I can't even imagine. I'm sure somebody has some software in the world that's like, want to know what you sounded like as a child? Here, apply this plugin. I'm sure it exists. I'm sure if you Google it right now, I mean, they have like software to make it, what are you going to look like when you're 70? You know, sure. There's like, what did you look like when you were five? You know?
Yeah.
What did you sound like when you were five?
Have you had conversations with them about music, sort of, you know, in a way that was similar or perhaps?
Our conversations revolve around what tickets I can get. So, for example, I just got a bunch of dates for my next European tour, and I had two options before me, and one of them fell on when Depeche Mode is playing Montreal. And so I said, I can't do this option one because I have to be here for the Depeche Mode show because I'm taking my kid to see Depeche Mode.
I've known you all my life, and this never occurred to you. And now you're gone.
Murray, I think those are my questions for you. I really appreciate you doing this deep dive on, you know, the literal mechanics of your voice, you know, your journey through music, how that's, you know, gone through multiple generations in your family. Like, this has been a real pleasure getting into it with you.
Oh, that's cool. I'm glad somebody gives a crap.
You probably have some bread to eat. Should I let you go?
Yeah, I actually have some work to do. My mother, this is total sidebar, but before my dad got sick, my parents used to have a religious broadcast in the States, on a station in Burlington or something like that. And they used to go into a studio, record the broadcast, drive the tape to the station and deliver it. And I'm just like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that. They used to do that like every week.
Yeah.
And so after my dad died, the station was like, hey, you know, you should start up to my mom, you should start up a broadcast again. So my mom was like, I don't know how I'm going to do that. And I was just like, I said, I'll tell you how you're going to do it. And so I got her a USB microphone, set her up at her computer, taught her how to record herself. So she writes the message, she records it, taught her how to weed. My mom is 86 years old.
Yeah.
I taught her how to send it to me via WeTransfer. And then I edit it and put me, I basically produce the broadcast.
Yeah.
Put some music, little intro, the message, I edit it, so take out all the blank spaces and clean it up and whatever, and then I send it to the station via transfer. And we've done 96 broadcasts.
Where
I'm gonna get off the phone with you to do. I have to
where can people find those?
That is on WCHP Radio on their website. It comes on Saturday mornings just before 11 o'clock. And so I've been doing that for the last, you know, year and a half, maybe 2 years.
That's
so,
very cool. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I mean, if you're feeling you want to be closer to God, then Anchored in Faith is your jam. That's the name of the show.
I'll sacrifice what little life, my saxophone and all that jive. I'll get a job and work as hard as God allows me to.
Once again, that was Murray Lightburn. His Once Upon a Time in Montreal is out this Friday. Please check it out. It's a gorgeous record through and through. His soundtrack for I Like Movies is also streaming now. Murray mentioned as we were getting off the call that he has another instrumental album in the works. I forgot to ask about New Deer's material. Their Lover's Rock from a few years back is a great listen. I listened to the first Deer's record, End of a Hollywood Bedtime Story, quite a bit while I was putting this together, though that's not that uncommon around here. A couple quick addendums. Apologies to Chandler Levac for calling her feature I Love Movies in there at one point. Apologies as well to the late, great Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops, another one of my favorite vocalists of all time, just a remarkable voice, another tenor baritone that rarely leaves my head. Before wrapping up, just a reminder that you can sign up to the Gut Feeling newsletter at buttondown.email/gutfeeling, which sends posts and podcasts directly to your inbox.
You can also subscribe to the podcast through Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Feel free to rate the show or spread the word about the podcast or the newsletter. Glad for the bump, either way. I think I'll just cut out from here. Thanks again for tuning in. If you're new, hope you hang around. Either way, I'll catch you all the next time.